Lawyer and activist Deborah Small is a leader in the drug policy reform movement in the United States. She has been for 20 years now. She's the founder of a public policy research and advocacy organization called Break the Chains, Communities of Color and the War on Drugs, the title of which is pretty self-explanatory, The Disproportionate Effect of Our Drug Laws on the Maori population in Aotearoa is well known. Deborah Small is here for the Cutting Edge Addictions Conference in Auckland next week. And she's with me now. Morena. Last we spoke 10 years ago, things have changed. How is your war on the war on drugs going?
Well, it's hard to have a war on something that the government claims it's not doing anymore. So one of the interesting things that's happened since I've seen you last, and thank you so much for bringing me back again, for inviting me to come and talk with you again. Under former President Obama, the government stopped officially using the term war on drugs because it had begun to have very negative connotations in the public. And at least rhetorically, they asserted a commitment to expanding access to treatment, to focusing less on law enforcement, to having a what we call a kinder, gentler form of drug policy. And to some degree, there was some supportive evidence of that during the Obama administration. Attorney General Holder advised the federal agencies to not prosecute people for marijuana offenses in the states where it was legal, either medicinally or otherwise. So we saw a real shifting in terms of the government's attitude towards cannabis right around the time that the public was starting to recognize how much of drug law enforcement in the U.S. was tied to cannabis and really turning against it. And it was also around the time that they were recognizing that we had a much more serious problem with opiates, and yet the majority of our law enforcement was focused on going after people smoking weed.
I'm interested in what the opioid epidemic has done to the attitudes of people in the United States, given that it is now identified as a corporate crime.
So, you know, there's two parts of that. So, yes, it is being recognized as a corporate crime, in part because there's this general conversation that this set of drug users were innocent people, as opposed to the prior set of drug users, black and brown, who chose to become addicted to crack. These people did not choose to become addicted to opiates. At least that's the general conversation.
And you're very skeptical of that, right?
Well, because this is the thing. It's like, number one, people have been using drugs in these communities for a long time. There are two things that are different. Not so much the use of opiates, but the introduction of fentanyl and OxyContin. So we've had heavy levels of opiate use, particularly in blue-collar neighborhoods, black and white, but particularly in white areas for a very long time. So much so that there have been a number of studies that have shown a decrease in white life expectancy due primarily to substance abuse and alcoholism and suicide. And for you to have data that shows a reduction in life expectancy, that means the problem has been around for a long time, much longer than what we've identified as the problem of overprescription of opiates. So there's a degree to which one of the unintended consequences of prohibition is that it enables some communities to be in denial about the drug problem in their neighborhoods, because in their world, that's not supposed to happen to them. So most, you know, middle class suburban white people believe that issues of drug addiction are inner city issues, they're minority issues, and therefore couldn't be happening to them or to their children or to their community. And it wasn't until people started dying in significant numbers of really primarily fentanyl-related overdoses.
In those white middle-class communities.
Exactly. Okay. That people began to recognize that drugs were there and it was a real problem and demanding some response. But in spite of the high level of overdose deaths, which last year I think exceeded 60,000, we still don't have a national policy of providing naloxone to everybody. of making sure that we have vigorous needle exchanges in every area so that people aren't acquiring infectious diseases, you know, as part of their drug activity. We still don't have a national harm reduction program that would have opiate substitution be available to people as a form of treatment. We're getting a little bit better around getting access to methadone in places. But given everything that we know about what works in treating addiction, you would think that this level of crisis would be an all hands on deck moment where the country would employ every strategy that it has to address the problem. But what we've gotten is a lot of rhetoric about, you know, being more treatment oriented, not focusing as much on the police. But in reality, the money has not been there. The same government now that talks about addressing the opiate crisis is also trying to restrict people's access to health care, which is one of the main avenues for helping people who have addiction problems. So I'm not that hopeful.
We were talking about the opioid epidemic last week and talking about the legal cases that are now moving through. And a lot of money is being asked of these corporates. But we were saying that in the case of Big Tobacco, a lot of that money did not go to the right places.
That's right. That was our experience.
And maybe this is going to be the same. You worried about that?
Absolutely. Because, you know, I was living in New York when we had a successful litigation against Big Tobacco. And the promise was that the proceeds to the state would go towards smoking cessation programs to support people who were trying to overcome tobacco addiction. But I can tell you, in New York City, a city of 8 million people, there were only 2 smoking cessation programs in the entire city, and neither one of them were in minority neighborhoods or poor neighborhoods. So, you know, the disconnect between the need and where the resources go has been a problem. And given that drug users are even more stigmatized than tobacco smokers, I don't hold a lot of hope that our government is actually going to follow through, even on a state level, of making sure that any settlement money that they do get from Big Pharma is actually going to go to help treatment for people many of whom are very poor.
So in the last 10 years, apart from the gentler, kinder rhetoric, what's really changed? You're in California now, where you've got legalization of marijuana.
Yes. And so this is the thing. What I think is that the public, quite frankly, on drug issues has changed a lot. When I first started doing this work, people were relatively comfortable with the punitive approaches towards arresting and incarcerating people for drugs. There's a major movement in the U.S. now to end mass incarceration that's pretty much supported across the board, across the country. It's been led primarily by formerly incarcerated people. But this is the first time in my lifetime that one major party has had criminal justice reform as a central issue in a presidential contest. Every major Democratic candidate talks about the need to reform the criminal justice system, to get people out of prison, to put more resources into community-based solutions as opposed to punitive solutions.
And this is meaningful? It's not, as you say, empty rhetoric?
Well, what's actually happened is that a number of states, including California, have actually passed laws doing their own sentencing restructuring. So we had a major legislation passed a few years ago where we reclassified many drug crimes from felonies to misdemeanors, where we made a specific effort to help people get out early, to put more money into reentry programs, to remove barriers to work. So if you live in California and you have a criminal conviction, you can't be asked about it when you're going to seek employment. It can't be used against you to keep you from getting housing. And there are other states that have done similar things to sort of ameliorate.
Nevertheless, in some states, people who have a felony drug conviction still unable to get public housing, still unable to ever vote.
Well, you know what's interesting about
that? Is that changing?
Yes. In 2018, Florida was one of the states that actually passed an initiative to change their constitution so that people who had felony convictions could get their voting rights restored. It was a major, major thing. And Florida was one of those states where you lost your voting rights permanently. But what's exciting to me about what happened there is that the effort to move that initiative and pass it was led entirely by formerly incarcerated people who put it on the ballot, who drummed up support for it, who went out and got people to come out and vote for it. No one thought that it would pass, but it did. Now, certain elements of the state are trying to put more barriers to people being able to have their voting rights restored by saying it's not enough to have done your time. You have to pay a lot of fines and blah, blah, blah. But the reality is that the public overwhelmingly supported the idea of voter registration restoration. And that's been more of where the public is around these issues. It's politicians who are afraid of having formerly incarcerated people vote. It's politicians who think that people who have drug convictions should be shut out of society. But the public doesn't feel that way, and increasingly they're voting in that way.
That's how you started off your activist career, isn't mm-hmm. it, with voter registration?
Mm-hmm.
The presumption would be that if there are more black Americans in jail, then it would suit a right-wing political party to keep them off the rolls.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the way it's gone?
Well, yes. And quite frankly, you know, it's not just black people. In Massachusetts, one in five residents of that state has a criminal record. Now, that doesn't necessarily keep them from voting, but it does keep them from lots of other things like job opportunities, et cetera. So, and having a criminal record doesn't mean you went to prison. There are a lot more people with criminal records who's never been in prison, and those records follow them forever. And so I think one of the things that's helping to shift public opinion is that people are recognizing that a person shouldn't be stigmatized and burdened for the rest of their life for a mistake that they may have made 10, 20, 30 years before. And not only that, but I also think that people are recognizing that the punitive approach to drugs has not worked. It hasn't made enabled people to have greater access to treatment. It's had us squander a lot of our resources on policing people when we should be trying to help them. And it's only driven drug use underground. So particularly around the opiate crisis, that's really made people think about it, because you had a lot of people needlessly dying alone because people were afraid to call the police for fear that they would be prosecuted because this other person overdosed. So the first thing that we did was pass Good Samaritan laws that said that if you call the police, if you and try to do rescue breathing or whatever for someone who's overdosed, you're not going to be charged with a crime.
Mm.
It seems like a no-brainer, but we actually had to pass laws for that. And so I think that as the public has learned more and more about these issues, they've recognized the futility of the things that we're doing. And quite frankly, you can't help someone if they're dead. And so the high level of overdose fatalities has really had people recognize, you know, that that's not the best way if you want people to get better. You have to reduce, you have to save their lives first.
One of the strongest arguments being used in this country for the decriminalization of marijuana is that we have synthetic cannabis here that is deadly. I mean, it's really killing people. And the presumption is that if marijuana is made legal and more easily accessible, then people won't be reduced to taking the horrible synthetics.
Well, that is true, but only if you don't overtax it out of the reach.
Well, because that's the crucial element, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, because
that's going to be the litmus test of the government's intent, because they will feel like they want to tax it in order to deter some people from it.
And the taxing isn't a deterrent. It only raises the price. It doesn't deter people from getting access to something if they really want it. We've learned over the years that drugs are not that price sensitive.
Having said that, tobacco's been priced hugely
mm-hmm.
by taxation in this country, and that is to a large extent responsible for the drop in the smoking.
I would push back on that because we did the same thing in the United States. And New York City, in fact, has one of the highest tobacco taxes in the country. And yes, less people smoke, but more disproportionately poor people continue to smoke. And disproportionately minority people continue to smoke in spite of the increase in price, because part of the reduction is related to people having access to other activities for stress reduction. So there's a relationship between the proliferation of gyms and other fitness activities with the reduction in smoking. But if you're a poor person and can't afford to join a fitness club or a gym and you have your life is still stressful, you're more likely to continue smoking, which is why you could have someone like Eric Garner be approached by the police for arrest because they believed that he was selling loose cigarettes on the street.
Yes, that's right. What do you think about how the increasing legalization of marijuana in the United States is going? It's not all good, is it?
I think, well, from my perspective, it is, primarily because it was black and brown people who were being primarily arrested for marijuana possession. So the fact that that can't happen anymore in places like California and New York, I think, is really important. The thing that we know is that the rate of marijuana consumption has stayed consistent over time, in spite of our efforts at law enforcement. The same number of young people have smoked marijuana or tried it. The same number of adults have smoked marijuana or tried it. And so the thing to me that legalization has done is to acknowledge that reality and improve the safety of the products that people are getting. So now in California, if you buy cannabis, it's labeled. You know the strain. You know the potency. You know the freshness. You know whether it's a sativa or an indica. And I think that for anything that people are consuming, they should be informed. They should have confidence that it is what it's supposed to be. And that's the main benefit to me of marijuana legalization, is that it's taken a product that people had to be, you know, questioning its potency, questioning its whether or not it was adulterated or whether or not it had been pesticide sprayed on it. Now we know. So that makes for safer consumption.
Do you think that the changes in the laws that you're seeing in the United States are due to what you would call a more enlightened attitude towards drugs, or the very basic need to get the prison population down?
I don't know that the majority of Americans actually believe that we have a need to get the prison population down. There are segments who
Despite the fact that you just said that people have accepted now that prisoners...
Because
prison
of who's getting locked up. And because, I mean, again, if you... I live in California, which has the largest percentage of homeless people in the country. Almost half of all homeless live in my state. And a lot of those people end up in our county jail. The jails in L.A. and New York and Philadelphia house more people with mental illness than all the psychiatric hospitals in the country. And so from my point of view, we still have a disconnect between our understanding of the problem of mass incarceration and the fact that we're still willing to lock up people whose principal problem is that they have a substance abuse issue or they have a mental health issue. You know, and part of it is because we haven't been willing to invest in the types of resources that you would need to provide people those services in the community. And as expensive as prison is, it's actually cheaper than making sure that people have adequate housing, a decent education, and adequate health care. And so we still have a ways to go, I believe, to, you know, not only reduce prison population, but actually increase services. Some of what's happening around mass incarceration is what I call doing time a little bit at a time. So instead of people going in for years and years, they'll cycle in and out of jail for 6 months, 7 months, 8 months, because their needs still aren't being met. Or increasingly, they're required to be under some form of criminal justice supervision. So they may not be in prison, but they have to wear an ankle bracelet. They have to constantly report to someone. And unlike when they're in jail or prison, they actually have to pay for the privilege of not going to jail or prison, which is totally wrong to me. So I think we still have some work to do to sort of recalibrate what justice looks like. And we need to address, you know, the continuing racial and gender disparities that are so evident in our system.
When you were last here, one of the stats that we were using was that one in every three black men in their 20s is either in the United States, either in prison or on probation or on parole.
Some form of criminal justice supervision.
What are the stats now?
They're pretty much the same. And I think it's one of the reasons why...
So while the prison population may be falling, the disparity of the black, white,
Hispanic... Hasn't changed. The number of... And again, the problem with framing the issue as primarily about mass incarceration means that you miss the huge numbers of people who are under supervision but not behind bars. So we have 2.5 million people behind bars, but we've got another 5 million people who are under justice supervision on any given day. Mm. So double the number of people are being, you know, controlled by the criminal justice system than the ones that are actually locked up by it. And so that is a bigger problem. So now many of us who've worked on reducing incarceration have tried to shift the frame to talking about criminalization, which incorporates all of those people, whether they end up in jail or not. And the tendency of our society to classify things as crime that really aren't crimes.
You were once in favor of drug courts. I think you changed your mind.
I did.
Why?
Well, because initially they were promoted as a way to support having vulnerable people, minority people, have access to treatment and avoid getting criminal records. But what we found is that as they developed, more and more restrictions were put on them that actually made it harder for black and brown people to get into drug court and harder for them to succeed. It became much easier to get a drug court disposition if you were middle class and or white than if you were poor and person of color. And if the basis for succeeding was never having a positive drug test, well, that's kind of stupid because, you know, using drugs is the disease that you're trying to cure. So the idea that you would punish people and take away their ability to continue in the program for demonstrating signs of their disease didn't make a lot of sense. And the final thing is that judges are not treatment providers, and they don't, and they're not experts on addiction. And so the problem and sort of the illusion around drug court was that judges could decide what was the best form of treatment for people. And it's not that they didn't care, but many of them didn't want their folks to be on methadone. They didn't want them to be in a harm reduction program. There, it was abstinence-only 12-step model, which actually doesn't work for the majority of people who are struggling with addiction. And so there are many aspects of it that I see drug courts as harm reduction for the system, not as necessarily something to help people. It allows them to process more cases more easily. It reduces some of the onus and the burden on prosecutors and judges. But in terms of being a principal vehicle, I think people should be able to access treatment outside of jail. And that was one of the things that troubled me when I went to visit Arohata prison here again this week. Most of the women who were there for drugs or alcohol, and almost all of them said that they had sought treatment in the community but weren't able to get it. And it wasn't until they got to prison that they were able to get into the kind of treatment program that they had been, you know, anxiously trying to get in their communities.
Mm. Although, I mean, I'm not suggesting that prison is a good place to be, but in terms of removing them from their previous, I don't know, drug-using community, it might be a circuit breaker in many cases, might it not?
Well, I think that residential treatment would accomplish that without all the onus that's associated with being locked up. I used to head the board for a treatment program for women in New York City that's provided support for women from the community or people who were returning from prison. And one of the things that I learned from that is that getting people off drugs is actually the easiest part. Helping them to rebuild their lives is the harder part. And that requires time. But for women, one of the biggest barriers to treatment is the fact that they don't want to lose their children. Most of them are mothers. So the problem with our current approach, even if it helps the woman to get off of drugs, the fact that she's separated from her kids is problematic for her and for the children. So one of the things we tried to do was create residential programs where women could be in treatment with their children so they could get better without having done harm to the family. And it made women more willing to be in treatment for a longer period of time because doing that wasn't at the expense of their parenting.
If New Zealand is going to decriminalize or legalize marijuana based on the outcome of the referendum next year, don't know, what would your recommendation be? You spent enough time here, talked to enough people to have a fair idea of what might work here. What do you think we should do?
Well, I think, you know, your country is very different from mine, but I think one of the lessons that I would hope you would learn from the U.S. experience is to avoid the over-commercialization of cannabis, letting big business come into it, try to keep the production small, try to keep it community-based, try to use a more collective model, business model, than the individual capitalist business model. And just as important, while tax revenues can be used in a really positive way, I think it's important that the cannabis not be overtaxed, because if you do that, you're going to maintain, you know, a black or gray market because you'll tax it out of the reach of poor people. And then I also think that, you know, there's a lot of conversation about restrictions on potency, et cetera. I think that that would be harmful to people who use cannabis medicinally. One of the good things that we found with cannabis legalization is that the states have legalized, have seen a reduction in opiate abuse because many people have been able to have found that cannabis is a good substitute for pain meds.
Although I've seen surveys that indicate that cannabis does not have much effect on pain levels.
It depends on what kind of cannabis. We have developed very high CBD cannabis, which is very good at pain management and inflammation. One of the advantages of having been in a state that had medical marijuana for 20 years, we've had registered more than 250,000 patients in California over that period, suffering from a variety of health conditions. And because of that, we've actually been able to see in real time, in real data, what types of illnesses cannabis is good for, what strains are good for different conditions, what are the things that actually help people. And there's no question regarding the evidence of cannabis's utility as pain management medication.
For general use, you don't have any problems, the high level marijuana being available to anybody?
Oh, I didn't say that. I think that the problem around that has more to do with how can I put it? There's always a subset of people who come to a drug with the desire to get as high as, you know, I don't want to say unconscious, but as altered as possible.
Sure. Same and with alcohol.
Exactly. But the majority of people who drink don't buy overproof alcohol. They don't drink to excess. We have the same problem with cannabis. There's a subset of people who are going to abuse it. But that's best dealt with as a health issue as opposed to a criminal justice issue. And it also doesn't make sense to make cannabis inaccessible to everyone because you want to protect 5% of the population.
Age limit?
We have an age limit.
What is it?
It's 21. You can't buy cannabis under 21, unless you have a medical prescription from a doctor. It's working really well. In fact, that was one of the big things that people worried about, both around medical cannabis and adult use cannabis, that young people would find it easier to get. But in reality, all the surveys that we've done have shown that there's actually been a decrease of cannabis consumption among young people.
Why would that be the case?
Well, now it's harder for them to get. It's like, you know, before legalization.
But isn't there still a black market?
Not as, well, yes and no. The black market that exists, at least that I'm aware of in California, is a market of businesses that do cannabis delivery. But they don't deliver to kids. You know, so it's like, it's not that easily accessible. One of the consequences of people who are in business who run dispensaries, they're not going to risk selling to kids because they could lose their license. It's not worth it. So I think it's actually proven to be a much more protective regime in terms of young people than the one that we had before.
Interestingly enough, I was just thinking, we talked about vaping early mm-hmm. this morning, and your deaths in the United States seem to have been attributable to people putting THC in their vape devices.
Mm-hmm.
Is that your understanding?
Or putting tobacco in their THC devices. I mean, from what I've read so far, the subset of people who've gotten ill from vaping are people who were smoking a lot of different things in combinations that were not authorized. It also seems that they were using, unlicensed vaping pens. So I feel like, again, anytime you have a regulatory scheme for anything, whether it's alcohol, tobacco, or whatever, there's going to be a subset of people who are going to continue to operate outside of that and create problems for themselves and other people. What I hope is that as people get more educated about the problems associated with vaping, that they'll think twice about getting them up at places other than licensed dispensary, that they'll think twice about adding things to the pens that don't belong there that could cause them harm. And quite frankly, you know, one of the goals was to move people away from smoking cannabis, because smoking itself can be harmful, towards other products, towards edibles, towards tinctures, towards beverages and gums. And that's one of the many things that is possible in a regulated system. And, you know, I believe in cannabis harm reduction. I think that all people should understand how the drug reacts in the body and how to consume it safely. And one of the things you could not do under prohibition is that kind of basic education. Now we can.
What about other drugs? Are you hoping that the decriminalization process will start extending to other drugs?
Yes, because I don't
believe...
All other drugs? All other drugs. I don't believe... So this is the thing. For me, I think that we often fail to distinguish the harms of drugs from the harms of drug policies. We see that we think of the drug policies as protective. But in reality, punitive drug policies only cause people to use drugs in more dangerous ways. And so I believe that we should never have criminalized something that's basically a public health issue. And I think more and more people are coming to recognize that. Does that mean that you're never going to have any problems related to abuse? You know, we had our experiment with alcohol prohibition. It was a colossal failure on every level. And when I say that our government went punitive, not only did we have mandatory sentences for alcohol offenses, but they were poisoning alcohol that they knew was going to end up in people's hands with the idea that it would deter them. It did not work. You know, it only caused more harm than good. And I believe the war on drugs causes more harm than the drugs that we're trying to protect people from. And that if we used our resources from a more health-related place, that we would focus on the people who are problematic users and find ways to help them as opposed to criminalizing them. I don't know too many people whose lives were made better by being labeled a criminal and locked up in a cell.
Good to talk to you again, Deborah Small. Is a lawyer and an activist. She's established Break the Chains. Break the Chains still going, of course.
Yes.
Communities of Color and the War on Drugs. Given that you moved to California, I wondered if...
Well, you know, it's funny because even in New York, my work was always national, and now it's become more international because as much progress as we are making in the States, places like Brazil and Colombia and Mexico and the Philippines are going backwards on drugs. And while most people don't realize it, there are substantial communities of color in those states, in those places, that are disproportionately affected.
How are you getting on with Mr. Duterte?
Oh, my God. My colleague was there a year or so ago. He received death threats when he was in the Philippines, just giving basic information about drugs. It's actually a scary time, and the level of ignorance of our current president around drugs is not helpful. He commends Duterte on his extrajudicial killings. He thinks that the Chinese having death penalty for fentanyl producers is a good thing. I think that that's awful, and so it saddens me that we've sort of given up the space of leadership around these issues and ceded it to others. But that's why being here in New Zealand is so important to me. You guys have shown leadership with respect to guns, which is an issue that we're still grappling with every day, in spite of all the evidence that should make it clear that we need gun control. We can't do it. So the fact that you were able to do it so quickly and thoroughly is inspiring. If New Zealand is able to move forward with legalizing cannabis countrywide, countrywide and have a drug law reform that decriminalizes, similar to Portugal, that's going to be a model for the rest of the country, for the rest of the world, particularly the global south, that I hope that people will follow.
We will see. Nice to talk to you. As I say, Deborah Small is here to address a cutting edge conference on drug addictions.